have an important interview lined up with RAIN, the Rape and Incest National Network. We talk about common hurdles victims face, as well as how to stay safe and be prepared when reporting a crime. After the interview, I'm going to talk about a new favorite podcast of mine that I think will help people heal with humor. So stay tuned for that. Today, we are speaking with Rebecca O'Connor, Vice President of Public Policy for RAIN, the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network. Rebecca, thank you for taking the time to speak with us today.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about RAIN, or R-A-I-N-N, and what your organization is and how it operates.
Sure. So RAIN, which stands for the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, was founded about 25 years ago and is the nation's largest anti-sexual violence organization. So we do four primary things. First of all, we provide best-in-class services for survivors of sexual violence and those seeking to support them. So we run the National Sexual Assault Hotline, which we founded, and it's a free, confidential, 24/7, 365 service. That is operated in partnership with more than 1,000 local sexual assault service providers to provide confidential support services to survivors no matter where they are in their recovery. And you can access that by telephone 800-656-HOPE or online through our website rain.org, R-A-I-N-N.org. And we also, through a contract with the Defense Department, operate a similar service, the DoD Safe Helpline, for members of the worldwide military community. So that's really the backbone of what we do, helping survivors. The second thing we do is make sure that we're educating the public and informing the public dialogue about this issue. So every year, working with the media and the entertainment industry and colleges across the country, among others, we educate more than 130 million Americans by providing accurate information about sexual violence prevention, prosecution, recovery, et cetera. And one of the hallmarks of that work includes a speakers bureau, which has more than 1,500 survivors who have volunteered to share their stories with the media and others to make sure that this, the human side of this is always being kept in mind. And then the policy team, which I head up, we have fun. We go to Capitol Hill and state legislatures and really press hard for laws and policies that do a couple of things. One, of course, enhance and support protections for survivors, but also seek to change the system so that it's one where more survivors feel comfortable coming forward and reporting these crimes, and we can hold more of these perpetrators accountable for them. And then finally, the fourth sort of arm of it is our consulting department, where our experts work with clients across the country, both in public and private and nonprofit sectors, to develop targeted and effective sexual violence education and response programs.
That's amazing. It's every branch of your organization is so important. I mean, from my personal research, I've just found the way that you're able to raise awareness and bring forth accurate statistics about what's going on has been hugely helpful.
Thank you.
To that end, the topic of this season for deliberations has been sexual assault and the oftentimes ambiguous nature of assault and harassment. So I know this is a very broad question, but how prevalent is sexual assault in our culture?
It's unfortunately the answer is extremely prevalent and pervasive. Based on Justice Department data, we know that approximately every 2 minutes, roughly every 98 seconds, another American experiences sexual violence. And that means, so for instance, in 2016, the Department of Justice estimates that 323,450 Americans age 12 and over experience sexual violence in some form. One in five women, one in 71 men will experience attempted or completed rape at some point in their lives. And every 8 minutes, Child Protective Services finds support for a claim that a child has been sexually abused. So it's something that knows no boundaries in our society. And the more we talk about it, the better, because it's certainly not going away anytime soon.
Absolutely. We've learned that acquaintance rape or, you know, acquaintance assault is much more common than stranger rape. And I think that would probably apply to every form of assault that you just mentioned on women, on men, and on children. Can you talk about why knowing your assailant provides challenges for survivors?
Absolutely, and I appreciate the question. You know, we've come a long way from the days when we thought that rapists were, you know, proverbial strangers hanging out in bushes. 7 out of 10 rapes are committed by someone known to the victim. So, certainly for survivors, it adds an additional layer of challenge. So you're weighing whether or not to report a crime to authorities, or even speak out about it and share it with a trusted confidant. And you have to balance the need to, you know, seek justice for yourself and healing and medical resources and what have you, with the very real, you know, challenges of making sure that, for instance, your family unit stays intact if the perpetrator is someone who is within your family, fear of retaliation, let's say, if it's your boss or a coworker that's perpetrated the crime. And so, you know, it's pretty obvious when you think about it, but at the same time, for those individuals, it can be wrenching to have to grapple with the choice between seeking support and then, you know, dealing with the consequences that can come. And that's why I think it's really important that our hotline service, for instance, is confidential in the sense we don't collect URLs or transcripts or anything when we have these conversations. So it's a good stepping stone for people that just want to have an outlet to talk about what happened, identify resources and what have you.
So are there times when your organization will receive calls then in which people are unsure about whether or not they've experienced an assault and they're trying to come to terms with that answer?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, for a lot of folks, again, we don't have granular detail because we don't collect it purposely, but we do know anecdotally that a lot of individuals, especially the younger visitors to our hotline, say it's the first time they've ever talked about this. And for some, you know, these are fine lines, even for those of us that are practiced in the field, to sort of distinguish between categories of crime and what happened. And so I think we've really evolved as in terms of what we're talking about here and how we talk about it as a society, sort of moving to that zero tolerance mentality that we need to adopt. But the reality is that there are still, you know, think about a college kid who goes to a party and doesn't know if what happened to them was, you know, their fault. And so that's the message we always immediately strive to communicate. Nothing, sexual violence is never the victim's fault.
Right. And taking on a sense of guilt or shame, I imagine, is a very common emotional experience following assault.
It is. It is, absolutely, and self-doubting, and, you know, it's just important that, and that's why we work really hard to train our staff and others to be able to meet someone where they are, because there's no uniform response to sexual violence, but that is a common theme that people, you know, move into self-doubt.
Right. And actually, in speaking about sort of gaining awareness about what's happened to each person personally and speaking to growing awareness across our culture and society, have you found that the Me Too movement, just out of curiosity, has escalated people's interest or attention in this regard?
Absolutely, yeah. For example, on the hotline, as I mentioned, we've been around for 20-plus years, and last year we served more than 200,000 people, which was a record for us on the hotline, and we're on track to do it again this year. We're getting record calls and requests for service. That's good news to us. It means that with Me Too and sort of the fact that this is front-of-mind news for so many people, the veil is being lifted, and people are stepping out of the shadows and sharing their stories and seeking support. But also complementary to that, lawmakers and others that need to pay attention to this to really move the needle are also doing so. So I've had no challenge in finding individuals that are eager and willing to step up to the plate and evaluate their laws and policies. And similarly, our consulting department and others have been inundated with requests from businesses and others that are looking to ensure that they're doing everything they can to both prevent and respond to these crimes responsibly.
Well, that is really encouraging news. And
yeah.
I imagine that moving the legislative needle is a painstaking and very long process.
It's a fun challenge to have. I think, you know, the bottom line is with any issue. When someone recognizes that it's personal for them, it certainly becomes a priority. And at this point, it's hard to look away from the Me Too movement and the surrounding headlines and to dissociate from this issue. So it's been really informative to see how lawmakers, again, from both sides of the aisle, from state capitals to the federal government, are really stepping up to the plate and asking, what else can we do here? So I have a really lucky position here to influence that and work with survivors and other experts in law enforcement and prosecutors to do it in a way that's collaborative. So we're all working together in concert.
That's wonderful. Speaking of law enforcement, can you identify for us what are some of the most common hurdles that survivors face and must overcome when they report a crime?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So, you know, with the caveat that, of course, every individual has their own story and experience and challenges, common things that we hear, and this really contributes to the really low reporting rate that we have for this crime in the country, is distrust of the system. So, there, for many survivors, the first hurdle is making that call, reaching out, choosing to report to law enforcement. And, you know, for many reasons, that can be very valid that historically we didn't know as much about these crimes, its perpetrators, and what sexual violence does to a survivor in terms of neurobiology and just their psycho and physiological response to it. So over time, a lot of survivors came to think, well, if I go and report this crime, no one's going to do anything or they're not going to believe me. So the good news is we've come a long way. And even though that is still something that a lot of people identify as a potential hurdle or a very real hurdle, I'm happy to report that law enforcement and others have invested time, energy, and resources into making sure that that won't perpetuate, right? That we're learning how to work in a trauma-informed, victim-centered way. But that's one challenge. And I really think that's the overarching thing. It's the stigma. It's the fear of not being believed that really can stop someone and have them remain silent.
Right, the whole emotional and mental journey that someone has to go through before making that choice.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So, to that end, what should any victim know in advance of reporting a crime? Like, what to expect?
Yeah. So I'll say that we get that question a lot. And to that end, I just want to flag that we have an entire sort of guide for people on our website, rain.org, because we want to make sure that people anticipate the types of questions that are going to be asked. I mean, the bottom line is, again, no one size fits all, but individuals should know that the system is designed and should be working to help them. And so survivors need to understand when they're thinking about going and reporting that there are resources that are available to them in the form of victim advocates, community-based and systems-based. So in law enforcement agencies, there are advocates that are dedicated to these issues. There are officers and investigators that are trained specifically on these issues and hopefully will meet them in a respectful way. But the other thing that I always want to underscore is that they are in control. They decide, and this is really important, when and how to share their story. And, you know, if you feel like you come forward and you're not getting the treatment and respect that you deserve and need, you have some control over how this situation unfolds. So you can request, for instance, to work with a different officer or, you know, to ask for an advocate to be present. And again, some of the questions that you're going to get, it may seem like I just answered that question and I don't know why you're asking. The goal ultimately is to make sure that we're documenting everything that you can provide to us so we can hold that individual accountable or that the agency can hold them accountable. So the one thing to say above and all is if you do choose to report, there's support available and we're here too if anyone needs to check in and talk it through at any stage in the process.
that is all really important information. I think that there are a lot of misconceptions alive. For example, I didn't know that you could request to speak with a different officer. So that just off the top of my head, that's something I wouldn't have known that a complaining witness would have control over. So that's really good.
Yeah.
You mentioned victims' advocates. Victims' advocates have actually come up over the course of our season. And just for anyone unsure about what the role of a victim's advocate is and whether this is a paid or volunteer position, can you just speak to what is a victim's advocate?
Yeah. So victims advocates, as I mentioned, come in a couple of varieties. So there are community-based advocates and, for instance, sexual assault coalitions or groups that work every day to support survivors are on the ground in your state, and they hire people and they train them. Some are volunteer. Some are on call, if you will. So and they train them so that they can be there in the capacity of literally being there just for you. Now, there may be limitations on, and it depends on your state's law and the agency for which they work, on how, you know, how involved they can be in certain meetings or discussions. But at the end of the day, there's someone who's there to help you navigate this system. So say to you, you know, this is the form that you're looking at, and this is why they're asking you to sign it. Or, hey, do you need a break? Or, you know, do you maybe want them to rephrase that question? Or are you overwhelmed and can I help? And also, you know, when an individual, for instance, goes to a hospital emergency room for a sexual assault forensic exam, there are advocates that are on call to be supportive to them as well. They may be hospital-based, they may be community-based. And then within the law enforcement agencies and prosecutors' offices and so on, again, it varies in terms of how this happens, but there are advocates available and an entire network of people that basically exist to ensure that survivors' interests, but also their rights, which are codified in every single state, are being upheld. So, for instance, the right to be treated with dignity throughout the process is one that's legal, and that the advocate is there to help sort of nudge along and enforce as need be.
Great. Right now we're sort of at the reporting part of the process. Just to back up a little bit, even before an assault occurs, I was wondering if you could share any knowledge with us about what men and women can do to stay, and children, and what anyone can do to stay safe from sexual assault and harassment.
Yeah, I mean, I think the very first thing to say is, again, that it's never a victim's fault. There's no such thing as wearing the wrong thing or saying the wrong thing that leads to assault, and so we never want to put the blame on a victim. But that said, you know, just like with any other crime, there are certainly things that you just have to be mindful of your surroundings. And certainly, I encourage people to learn about this crime, so red flags can be caught early on. You know, a lot of this comes down to, especially when we talk to kids, we teach them about understanding what safe touch is. And I have 2 5-year-olds that came home from school and said they learned to say, "Stop it, I don't like it." And that's the line for them if something feels unsafe to them. I think at the end of the day, teaching yourself all you can about, you know, sort of how these things happen, coming to websites like ours to learn about sort of tips for staying safe, for instance, when you're traveling, whether it be take the earbuds out so that you can be aware of your surroundings, or, you know, scan your cabin on a cruise ship to make sure you understand whether or not there's a camera that's watching, as it's supposed to be under law, for what happens in the area around your front door. Just common sense steps. But at the end of the day, we can't prevent all crimes. And again, it's in the hands of those that perpetrate these things to prevent them entirely.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny. It was a listener who reached out on Facebook and suggested that I speak to someone for an interview about tips to stay safe. And I was thinking about that. And when I think about tips to stay safe from rape and assault, I typically think of stranger-based rapes. You know, I think about self-defense techniques, and I think about mace, and I think of all those kind of easy ways to address the problem. But I imagine it gets much more complicated when you try and have a conversation about how to stay safe with acquaintance rape.
It does, absolutely. I mean, having worked at one point in my life in the area of domestic violence, where you're living with your abuser, and often there's overlap here, of course, with sexual assault, every survivor, every victim, every potential victim knows what the triggers are for an individual if they suspect that someone in their life or they experience abuse at the hands of someone in their life, if they have the propensity for it. And so every survivor sort of has that sixth sense and knows, okay, I know what sets, and I'm going to say him, and of course both men and women perpetrate these crimes, but you know, they know what's in their best safety and interest. So I hesitate always to sort of lay blanket, do this, do that approaches to staying safe. That said, there are certainly, of course, if it makes you feel safer, if it makes you feel more secure to take classes and to, carry mace or what have you, that's certainly okay. But I would never discourage someone from it. But the one thing that I'm always just trying to make sure people understand is, and I know I'm beating a dead horse, but it's so important that they understand that there's no one thing that you can do to prevent somebody from choosing to commit a crime. And so I'm loath to have people self-blame.
Yeah, absolutely. You've mentioned that a few times, so I imagine that must be a really integral part of your work, and that must be an extremely common aspect of this job that you face every day.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely, it's not the only theme, but it definitely is one that emerges a lot, especially with younger individuals. It's just one of those things that we need to keep hammering home, because I think at the end of the day, that gets down to the root of why people are finally realizing that it's okay to say me too, that they're realizing that nothing they did contributed to what happened to them, and they're not willing to stand for it.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for making the time to speak to us today, Becca. You've provided a lot of valuable information, and I want to make that information accessible to anyone who wants to learn more. So we will be providing a link on our social media pages.
Wonderful.
That people can check out RAIN, learn more about RAIN, find ways to stay safe, and there will also be an URL that people can donate directly to the organization.
Oh, thank you.
Absolutely. Can you speak to where this money would go and sort of the impact of the gift?
Absolutely. So, first of all, thank you to anyone that takes the time to donate. I think it's important to recognize that when you give to RAIN, you're not just giving to an organization. You're helping to improve the lives of thousands of people affected by sexual violence. So, we commit that 93 cents of every dollar donated goes directly to our programs and services, including the hotline. And we offer a creative suite of ways to give. So, I just want to flag that, if doing a one-time donation is what you choose, that's fantastic. And it just so happens that April is Sexual Assault Awareness and Prevention Month, and we'll be offering a match. But we also do some creative giving strategies. So if you want to, for instance, create a page and dedicate your birthday for a fundraiser, you can do that through RAIN. And we have a 5K, a virtual 5K coming up called Lace Up for RAIN, where no matter where you are in the country, you can sign up, create a page, create a team, and have a blast spending a beautiful day raising funds for the organization.
Amazing. Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much, Becca. I think that...
Thank you.
Yeah, I think that we've done a lot of... we've covered a lot of interesting ground, and personally, I've learned a lot over the course of this conversation, so I hope our listeners may be able to take something away from it, as I have.
Thank you. We really appreciate all of your interest.
Thanks to Rebecca O'Connor for giving us this interview. Before we go, I want to talk to you about a new favorite podcast of mine. It's called Suicide Buddies on Starburns Audio. Throughout this season, we breach some heavy topics, you might have noticed. And one thing that hasn't escaped me is that we've all been touched in some way by sexual assault, and that it, like any trauma, could lead to some really dark places. Suicide Buddies is a comedy podcast about mental health. In each episode, comedians Dave Ross and Hampton Young talk about one suicide in history while sharing their own experiences and dark thoughts, somehow, miraculously. in a casual, funny way that will make you feel comfortable and uplifted. It's honestly just like My Favorite Murder, but for suicide. It could be called My Favorite Suicide, but obviously, it's probably good that it's not. We're all trying to get better. Dave and Hampton want you to feel better too. They're hoping a full hour of the world's darkest jokes will help. I love positive approaches to negative subjects, and this podcast hits it out of the park. If you like history, dark humor, or enjoy creative mental healing, you will love Suicide Buddies. Search for Suicide Buddies anywhere you find your podcasts. I hope you like it as much as I do. In 2 days, the final installment in the trial of Keith Montgomery drops. We'll see you then.